Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, you're listening to The Health Report with me, Norman Swan. In this program, making your heart better by making your own decisions. Absence doesn't make the heart go fonder, at least when it comes to the treatment of older people for high blood pressure. And overnight, a major international trial led by an Australian team has confirmed a life-saving measure for people with diabetes. In fact, it's probably the largest trial of its kind in the world to date. If you have diabetes, regardless of your blood pressure, there's a case for you to be on blood pressure-lowering medications. It can save your life and probably your kidneys too. A leading member of the team running the trial is Professor Stephen McMahon, who's director of the George Institute for International Health at the University of Sydney.
We were trying to find ways to improve the prognosis associated with diabetes. Most people with diabetes will die or be disabled as a consequence of the complications, and we were looking at practical ways to reduce those complications.
Particularly heart disease and disease of the arteries.
Yes, we were interested in the two main vascular complications of diabetes, and that is blockages in the major arteries, the heart and the brain, but also in the smaller arteries in the kidney and the eye.
What did you do?
We recruited 11,000 patients with diabetes from all around the world, both developed and developing countries, and we randomly assigned them to treatment with a simple regimen, which was a single tablet in which there were two blood pressure drugs, or to a placebo against the background of all the usual drugs that diabetic patients get.
We should just do a declaration here. This is a drug company-funded study?
The primary sponsor for the study was Servier Laboratories, who are the manufacturers of the drugs that we studied, but it was also funded by the Australian National Health and Medical Research Council.
And the degree of independence from the drug company?
100%. The study was initiated by us, conducted by us, reported by us, independently of all sponsors.
So the study was of two things, as far as I understand it. One is really getting a hold of the person's diabetes and getting it really well under control so that you're really wrestling that to the ground, plus getting the blood pressure down, irrespective of whether or not you actually had high blood pressure, because a previous study at the George Institute had found that if you are at high risk for other reasons, you can just reduce your blood pressure no matter what the level and still get a benefit.
That's exactly right. There were two main questions that we addressed, and the one that we've released today is the result related to blood pressure, but there is an ongoing part of the study which is also looking at blood sugar or blood glucose levels. The questions are very similar. If you really drive down the blood pressure, if you really drive down the blood glucose, do you make a difference to the outcome?
And what were the findings?
The most important finding of the blood pressure component was that mortality was reduced. So the death rate in these patients with diabetes was reduced. So overall, the death...
And this was over 5 years?
This was over 5 years. So death from cardiovascular disease, which is the leading cause of death in diabetes, was reduced by about 18%. And that meant over 5 years, we prevented about one patient in every 80 from dying.
And that was in the group that got the high blood pressure treatment, even
Correct.
Though you may not have had high blood
Correct.
Pressure. And was the risk reduction greater if indeed you walked into the study with higher blood pressure?
No, that's an important aspect. As you alluded to earlier, we've previously done work which has proven that in some situations, even people whose blood pressure is not high can benefit from blood pressure lowering therapy. So in this study, the main reason that we included patients was because of diabetes. We didn't care what their blood pressure was, whether it was high or low. And our objective was to see whether or not lowering average or below average blood pressure in diabetics was beneficial. And the results suggested that irrespective of whether your blood pressure was high or low, if you had diabetes, you benefited.
And you also got other benefits as well, particularly in the kidneys.
Yes, probably the largest benefit appeared to be for the kidneys. We showed about a 20% reduction in the risk of patients developing new or worsening kidney disease. The most common occurrence is something called microalbuminuria, which is the very start of the leakage of protein out of the kidneys. And that occurred in a very large number. About 2,000 of the patients experienced that. And so a 20% reduction in that sort of risk is quite important.
So is this working through blood pressure reduction or something else? What's happening here to prevent these deaths and prevent the kidney disease?
Well, the study doesn't really help us specifically determine what the mechanism is, but certainly the rationale was because we used a combination of blood pressure lowering drugs, it was to test the effects of blood pressure lowering. That's not to say that there might not be special effects of particular drugs, but our hypothesis and our interpretation is that blood pressure lowering is a major part of this benefit.
And do you think it's specific to these two drugs, or do you think it's generic to blood pressure lowering?
I think that there is good evidence now in a variety of different patient populations that a variety of blood pressure lowering drugs will do this. The biggest question, I guess, is about the kidney effects. And there's a lot of debate as to whether or not there are different effects of different drugs. And one of the drugs that we used in this was an ACE inhibitor, perindopril. And that class of drugs is believed to have particular benefits for kidney disease. But it's a very controversial subject.
And was there any sense in your study that the benefits were starting to tail off? In other words, you were getting benefits at 5 years. That's kind of an economic point in terms of the cost of the trial. But were there signs that if you'd continued for 10 years, the benefits would continue to increase?
There was no evidence that the benefits were particularly time-related. So obviously, the longer you're on treatment, the bigger the benefits.
So it accumulates.
But there was no evidence that there was any attenuation of the benefit towards the end of the period.
And how soon did they kick in? Because there's been a lot of talk about how, in fact, this kind of treatment may actually have quite an immediate effect on the body. And it's just that your chances accumulate as time goes on.
It's difficult to determine exactly when the benefits kicked in. If we look overall, I mean, there appears to be maybe a different time frame for different effects, and it's hard to, I guess, give a single answer for that.
One of the other dreaded effects of diabetes is on the eye, and the eye, you start to lose your vision if you don't have your eye checked up regularly. The results were a bit disappointing for the eyes.
Yes, they were disappointing. Previously, the evidence had suggested that blood pressure lowering might have its largest effects on the eye, and we didn't see anything at all. And that could be the consequence of the fact that eye care for diabetics is now very, very high.
So the extra margin you get from blood pressure.
So it might be that there really wasn't a lot of extra benefit that could be derived in that regard.
What about the cost versus benefit of this?
Well, that's going to be an ongoing analysis for us. However, our expectation at the moment is based on that observation of about the prevention of one death in 80 patients over 5 years. That's a pretty good result in terms of the cost benefit. But we have more detailed data about that within about 6 months' time.
And you mentioned that some of the people in this trial were in developing countries. Could they afford this kind of treatment?
Yes. In most developing countries, these drugs are available. ACE inhibitors and diuretics are available either as patented products or as generic products. In countries like India and China, these drugs, at least in their generic form, are available for a few cents a day. So there is certainly great capacity in those countries to avoid a lot of diabetes-related disease with this treatment.
And you've done a calculation of how many lives might be saved globally?
Yes. At the moment, there's about 250 million people worldwide with diabetes. If only half of those were to receive treatment such as this, it should result in the avoidance of about 1 million deaths a year.
Pretty impressive. So when are the results going to come out on the diabetes control?
The results for the diabetes control will be released early in 2008, and that part of the study actually comes to an end at the end of December this year.
Stephen McMahon, who's director of the George Institute for International Health at the University of Sydney. And you're listening to The Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Now to Britain, where they recently stopped a high blood pressure trial because it was unethical to continue. The reason for calling a halt, though, was actually good news. It was a trial attempting to resolve a long-standing controversy about whether, if someone's over 80 and has high blood pressure, they should be treated. Some have said yes, and some have said no, it's too dangerous. Now there's an answer. The person who coordinated the trial was Dr. Nigel Beckett, who's at Imperial College London.
There's been two aspects of the debate. First of all, there's been some epidemiological studies that have suggested that people with high blood pressure actually do better than people with low blood pressure over the age of 80. And that's been shown in numerous studies over the last 30 or 40 years, really.
And by doing better, what the idea is that you've got this blood pumping through your body and you don't want to compromise it.
Yes. You have to interpret the data with a little bit of caution because we know that people who have other diseases such as cancer, dementia and such as advanced heart failure will have lower blood pressure, and therefore it's not the fact that high blood pressure is good for you, it's more that maybe low blood pressure could be a sign that you have other things going wrong, other diseases.
It's one of these pitfalls from taking information from what's called observational studies, where you just look at a group of people and say, boldly, people with high blood pressure seem to do well, rather than testing the assumption.
That's right. And even when you try to narrow it down and look at other variables within your data, there's still that problem of possible confounding, i.e. there may be something else going on within the data that's giving you this apparent benefit from having high blood pressure.
But there's also been mixed news about lowering blood pressure as well, hasn't there, until now?
That's right. There is absolutely no doubt up to the age of 80, if you have high blood pressure, you benefit from treatment. There's no doubt about that. But the evidence for those people over the age of 80 has been somewhat mixed. That's really come about by the fact that people have never really recruited enough people into studies over the age of 80 to actually give a definitive answer. Some studies have recruited too few. Some have actually actively excluded people over the age of 80. There has been one study where they got all the people who had been recruited to about five or six studies and put them all together and did a meta-analysis on them. And that showed quite an interesting result, suggesting that perhaps that strokes were reduced, but there was a possibility that there may be an actual increase in mortality. In other words, people may get some benefit in terms of preventing them having a stroke, but
they die of something else.
They die of something else, or there's an adverse effect from the medication, an adverse effect of lowering blood pressure. So there was this uncertainty, and that's caused a lot of problems, particularly for physicians treating very elderly individuals. We know, for example, that people who are taking antihypertensive medication do have a tendency to fall over a bit more. Their blood pressure may drop when they stand up, they get a little bit dizzy, they fall over, they're an increased risk, therefore, of sustaining a fracture of their hip, for example. And that would carry with it certain mortality, certain morbidity as well. So there's always been this sort of dilemma as to what you should be doing with people with high blood pressure over the age of 80. And that was really the premise on which our study was founded, to try and establish what were the benefits and what were the risks.
So describe the people who were in your trial and what you did with them.
We have a mixed bunch of folk in terms of where we recruited patients from. We recruited patients from Western Europe, Eastern Europe. We recruited patients from China. A few came from Australia and some from New Zealand. And we also have some from North Africa, from Tunisia.
And I suppose we should just get the declaration up front. This was a drug company-sponsored study?
No, the sponsor, the legal sponsor for it was Imperial College, so it was a university initiated and led. And we had funding for the study from two sources. One was from a charity, the British Heart Foundation, and we also had funding from one pharmaceutical company that supplied and distributed the drugs that were used in the study. And the drugs we used was a low-dose diuretic called indapamide, a slow-release formulation, 1.5 milligrams, with the addition of an ACE inhibitor called perindopril, and that was at a dose of 2 or 4 milligrams.
And did the drug company have any role in the analysis or write-up?
None at all.
So were these older people, so they were over 80, were they typical of the general population? Because one of the criticisms of trials like this were that we're not going to have somebody who's left-handed, or we're not going to, you know, I'm exaggerating obviously, but exclude so many people that it doesn't become a real-world story.
Yeah, I think that's a fair criticism of many studies. And for us, we tended to look at those who were the fitter spectrum of those over the age of 80. So, for example, if a patient was living in a nursing home, we did not recruit those type of patients. So they tended to be living predominantly at home. They could come into the study if they were just living in a residential home, so that they were ambulant, they could get out and about. So from that respect, we were targeting the fitter people over the age of 80.
And how high was their blood pressure?
Blood pressure, you had to have a systolic blood pressure of at least 160 millimetres of mercury.
That was 160?
Yeah, to get into the study.
And that's the top figure, and the bottom figure, the diastolic?
The bottom figure, when we originally set up the study, you had to have a diastolic blood pressure of at least 90, but we removed that.
And this is because as you age, often what happens is when your blood pressure goes up with age, it's just your top figure that goes up and your bottom figure remains relatively normal because your blood vessels are relatively inelastic. They're stiff and therefore you tend to get a sort of top-end high blood pressure.
That's absolutely right. As you get older, your systolic blood pressure steadily increases with age and your diastolic will increase until about the age of 50, 55, and after that it'll tend to reduce slightly. So the difference between your top pressure, your systolic, and your bottom pressure, your diastolic, what we call pulse pressure, tends to get bigger, certainly over the age of 50 or 55.
So you had people just with systolic high blood pressure, and you randomised them, obviously, to treatment or placebo. And what were the findings?
The findings that we've been reported to us, because at the moment the analysis has been done independently of us by an independent data monitoring committee, and that showed that there was a significant reduction in stroke. But also there was a significant and not trivial reduction in mortality as well.
So overall death rates from any cause?
Yes. So based on that, our independent data monitoring committee generated a report that was seen by an independent ethics committee, and the overall recommendation was that the trial should be stopped. That recommendation was submitted to our steering committee, which again is independent of us, and their recommendation was to accept the report and that the trial should be stopped because of the shown overwhelming benefit from active treatment.
And what you're talking about here is the increasing trend in large trials to have people who are not involved in the trial, therefore no vested interest, who look over the safety and what's happening in the trial so that the participants have that extra level of protection.
Absolutely.
You also looked at heart attack and the risk of a broken bone. What were the results with heart attacks?
We don't actually have that data available at the moment primarily.
And were you looking at bone fracture because of this risk of falling over or because of the risk of the additional risk of osteoporosis from the anti-high blood pressure medication?
We're looking at it from two aspects. One, because of the risks of falls, so just to get a feel for the number of falls that people are getting and potential fractures. And also because there's some evidence to suggest that with thiazide diuretics, because it reduces the amount of calcium that you pass out in your urine, it may actually possibly reduce the amount of fractures.
So we're going to have to wait a while to find the analysis on those figures?
Yes. At the moment, we've informed all our investigators, and our investigators now are all bringing their patients back to have a final visit and to discuss ongoing antihypertensive medication, because obviously we have patients who are on placebo and they will be
offered the treatment.
Offered treatment now.
What does this do for medical practice then? If you yourself are over 80 or you've got a relative who's over 80, what's the story now?
I think the story now is that there is sufficient evidence that if you have a blood pressure of over 160 over the age of 80 and you're reasonably fit and well, then the evidence now suggests that you will do better with treatment than you do with not having treatment. I think the other thing to say is that we haven't treated people with blood pressures of between about 140 and 160 systolic, so that's still going to potentially be a slightly ongoing debate.
Just finally, lifestyle measures do affect blood pressure. If you exercise, they say, you know, 3 or 4 times a week for 30 or 40 minutes, it will reduce your blood pressure. If you reduce your alcohol intake, if you lose weight, if you reduce salt in your diet. Do we know the effects of those lifestyle measures on the over 80s?
Not a great deal, no, because, again, those lifestyle interventions have never really been tried out a great deal in that age group. As a general principle, though, it would seem reasonable that people in their 80s continue to take exercise. It maintains muscle mass, it maintains fitness. We know that as you get older, you become slightly more sensitive to salt, and therefore there would be the suggestion that you would potentially even get better results from some salt reduction. If you're overweight, yes, reduction in weight would also be useful. And again, things such as alcohol in moderation, particularly because the effect of alcohol can be a little bit greater as you get older.
Increase the risk of falls?
Absolutely.
Dr. Nigel Beckett, who's at Imperial College London. The acute coronary syndrome is a dangerous and common medical emergency. Someone with an acute coronary syndrome often has had angina in the past. That's chest pain, usually on exertion, due to a shortage of blood going to the heart. Angina is normally relieved by dissolving an angina tablet under the tongue. With the acute syndrome, though, the angina gets progressively worse over a period of time, usually hours or days, and the person has it at rest. That's called unstable angina and is a sign that a blockage in an artery supplying heart muscle is breaking up, threatening to block the artery more completely, causing a heart attack. And indeed, a certain type of heart attack, which doesn't show up clearly on the electrocardiogram, but does on testing for a chemical in the blood, is also part of the acute coronary syndrome. People can also develop an acute coronary syndrome without a history of angina, and their unstable angina is their first experience of chest pain. If you experience these kinds of symptoms, you need to call an ambulance and get to the emergency department as fast as you can so you can have appropriate treatment, because the risks of death and repeat heart attacks are high. But while most of the medical shows on TV focus on the hospital, the key thing is what happens when a person goes home. Because if you don't do anything about your risk factors, the chances of another coronary event at some point are almost 1 in 2. Enormous. So someone who's come through an episode like this needs cardiac rehabilitation to get themselves in order. But only a small minority of people receive it, which is why Dr. Julie Redfern and her colleagues at the University of Sydney at Concord Hospital and the University of Western Australia have devised what they think might be a more accessible and indeed effective form of cardiac rehabilitation, which might better suit people who've had the acute coronary syndrome. Julie Redfern.
Cardiac rehabilitation has been around for 10, 20 years. It involves people generally coming to the hospital for about an hour, 2 hours a week and doing exercise in a gym and also some education about reducing their risk factors for about 8 weeks. And we have reported early this year in the Medical Journal of Australia that the people who don't actually go to cardiac rehabilitation have the highest level of risk and the poorest knowledge of their risk factors.
They're the ones who need it most.
Yeah, so the 4 in 5 who've had an acute coronary syndrome but don't go to cardiac rehabilitation are at the highest risk.
And is it proven that cardiac rehabilitation saves your life?
Yes, cardiac rehabilitation has had great outcomes, but as I said, only 1 in 5 people go. So we wanted to look at the 4 in 5 who don't go and see if we can help them.
When you looked at these people, what were the barriers to them getting involved? Is it just that they didn't have cardiac rehabilitation available to them, or they didn't want to go, or what?
There's a range of reasons why people don't go to cardiac rehabilitation. A lack of referral is a major problem, and it's about 45% of the people are not actually referred to the program.
This is the interminable problem where cardiologists who should believe in cardiac rehabilitation the most don't actually believe in it and therefore don't refer
you
on.
Well, I think they do believe in it, but you know, sometimes the people might come in on a Friday night into emergency with an acute event, maybe go home on a Sunday night, and they sort of miss the nets in the system, if you like. But the other problems include things like living outside the area, not speaking English. The patients literally don't want to go. They feel like they're already doing exercise. Maybe it's not supported by the general practitioner or the cardiologist, as you said. They maybe don't have transport to get to the programs. Maybe they work. They can't go to the hospital at 10 o'clock of a morning. What we think is the people that don't necessarily want to exercise, don't want to be told not to smoke, maybe they're the ones sometimes that don't go.
So what did you do?
We looked at all the evidence and the literature for helping people change their own behaviour, and we wanted to develop a model that was patient-centred, where the patients have some choice and some flexibility in what they're going to do, and we wanted to do an individualised program and target the people not going to existing rehab.
Advertising people seem to know how to change people's behaviour. What is known, in fact, in the medical sphere about changing people's behaviour? What are the features of things that will stop me being a smoker or stop me having the hamburger and chips at lunchtime?
The evidence suggests one of the biggest factors, if the patient is actively engaged in the decision-making process for changing their behaviour, they feel like they have some control over what they will do and how they will do it.
This is rather than being lectured to, thou shalt not eat hamburger and chips at lunchtime and thou shalt not smoke.
Absolutely, yeah. So we wanted to take a step back from the traditional, I guess, medical model, if you like, and sort of say, all right, these are the things the National Heart Foundation recommends. What do you feel you could do to help yourself? And then to try and work within what was available within the local area as well. So we weren't just making people dependent on the hospital system, but actually trying to utilise the already available services in the community. One of the other big things in the behavioural literature is the fostering of the therapeutic alliance between the patient and their healthcare provider. So the patient feels that they have some say and they work together with the health professionals, not just being told, do this, do that.
So this is like a contract?
Well, yeah, they sign a written action plan and we set goals with them, and the patients are involved in choosing a goal that they feel is achievable. We get them to rate how confident they are in achieving that goal out of 10, and if they didn't think they could achieve it, so it was less than 7 or 8 out of 10, we'd get them to reset that goal. Let me just give you an example. If someone who was very overweight, maybe had a body mass index of around 40, for me to come up to them and say, okay, you need to achieve a BMI of 25 in the next 2 months, potentially to that person that may be counterproductive, and they may walk out and think, oh, that's ridiculous, what's she talking about?
And of course it is ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we try to do is step back from there and say to the person, okay, you've got a body mass index of 40. For good health outcomes, around 25 would be ideal, but what do you think might be achievable for you in the next 2 months? And we'd sort of put it to the patient, and then we'd discuss some options within the community that they could do to try and achieve that goal as well.
And do you provide help for them to do it?
not necessarily the person delivering our program. The person delivering our program is about channeling that individual out into various programs. So we may discuss with the patient, okay, well, there's this weight loss clinic at this hospital. It would cost you this amount of money, and this is how you can attend and refer them to that program. Someone else may wish to go to a local weight loss program of their own doing. Someone else may wish to work closely with their GP to lose the weight. So we would let the patient sort of direct us, and we would help channel and direct them into the appropriate program.
And somebody else might say, well, I'm going to stay at 40, but I'll try and stop smoking.
Yes, absolutely. And then what we would do with that individual is say, okay, then in 2 months' time, when we follow them up, we would then revisit the weight loss, maybe when they dealt with one issue at a time, because that's one of the other principles of behaviour change, maybe trying to expect people to make 8 changes to their life in a single leap is maybe not as effective as taking small steps along the way to achieve the goal.
You were describing cardiac rehabilitation as multiple visits in traditional terms. You did this in a very short intervention, didn't you?
We saw the patients for about an hour in the first instance face-to-face. We did a complete risk factor assessment, identified which risk factors they had, and then we would set goals, choose the modules that they would participate in, refer the patients as required, and then the patients would go off and participate in their chosen and strategies, and then we would telephone them an average of 4 times over the 3 months, and that was the only actual intervention we delivered.
And this was a randomised trial?
Yeah, we did a randomised control trial with a control group, an intervention group, and we also did a parallel non-randomised group who participated in standard rehab.
And what did the control group get?
The control group did just ongoing conventional care.
And did you change the system so that you lost fewer people? In other words, you captured more of these 4 out of 5 people so they weren't lost to referral?
In fact, for this particular trial, we only accessed people up to around about 4 to 6 months after they'd been in hospital.
And oh, so in it fact, wasn't immediate?
No, just because to get the number of patients we were looking at for the randomised controlled trial with the issues about recruitment and volunteering and whatnot. So we believe it'll even be stronger if we get them as soon as possible after the
And what were the results?
We found that pretty well compared to control, our intervention group significantly lowered the level for all the major risk factors, including total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, blood pressure. We had fewer smokers. They were more likely to be physically active.
And what about maintaining it beyond the 3 months?
For all of the risk factors, they maintained the changes at 12 months. Yeah, so we only
Does
actually...
Does anybody know how long you've got to follow people up with the odd sort of top-up to
no,
get people
we don't,
motivated?
No, we don't know that. In fact, we are just designing now a multi-centre trial where we will compare more intensive ongoing feedback for up to 12 months compared to just the 3-month program.
So what did people tell you about the program when you asked them about it, what it was like for them?
People like being able to be involved in changing their risk factors. People would ring up and ask for advice, and people would come really excited to the next appointment to show me that, you know, one man just of his own accord went to the post office and got the calendar and had circled every day that he'd done his walking. So he'd come up with his own ideas about how to monitor his own walking. And I think that's one of the powerful things of the intervention. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're able to maintain that change, because people were able to fit the changes into their own lifestyle.
Is this applicable on a wider scale in the real world, outside a randomised trial?
We believe it's absolutely applicable. We're just about to start a multi-centre implementation trial. Implementing, that's what we really want to do. We want to help people with heart disease, and we want to help these people for which there's currently no program at the moment. We're talking about 24,000 Australians who have a heart event but don't access cardiac rehabilitation every year. The other interesting thing is that we think it's potentially quite transferable to other chronic diseases. The risk factors, cholesterol, blood pressure, overweight, physical inactivity, smoking, are common risk factors across a whole range of chronic diseases, including stroke, diabetes, even cancer. Whether we can look at addressing the risk factors that are common across all of the disease processes with a similar type of program would be fantastic.
Dr. Julie Redfern is a researcher in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Sydney. I'm Norman Swan, and I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.